I haven't seen The Kitchen, but I hear I didn't hear good things about it, so I just skipped.
It's really quite bottom drawer. You know, it's pulpy. It's not that sharp. I mean, every now and then, especially in the latter half, and I would say even the latter third, there are some scenes that kind of work. And it's not painful to sit through, but it's just not anywhere near the level of the Steve McQueen film Widows, which, you know, some people were cool on and some people liked it more. But it's much, much better film than The Kitchen. And it's essentially more or less the same idea, the same basic premise, same basic plot. So.
I'm sure it makes you appreciate what Steve McQueen did more.
That's precisely. I mean, he's a real... I mean, a guy who's pretentious enough and cool enough to do that car hood shot in which you just hear people talking and the camera moves through different neighborhoods while the conversation... I love that. I love that stuff. I eat that shit up, but that's, you know, that's what I love about McQueen, so...
He took so many risks in that movie. Even from the very first scene where it goes back and forth between Viola Davis... and her memories of Liam Neeson's botched heist.
That's
at the very beginning. I love the editing in that opening sequence. But I remember when Widows came out, there was Oscar buzz for it, or when it premiered at TIFF, and then it just kind of died down.
Cause I think people understood after a little while that it was. It was essentially a genre film, a good one, but it didn't have that, I guess, that cultural or spiritual aspiration quality. It didn't seem to transcend itself. It seemed to be more or less content to be a high-end genre film, which I was totally fine with. But...
I don't think it was that commercial... of a movie for audiences to you know, eat up and tell the friends about. It was very much an art house genre movie, which I really appreciated McQueen doing that. But and also, like, when you go into a Steve McQueen movie, I mean, you should expect, you know, something that isn't really that commercial.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, all his movies before that were...
Right.
Fairly art house, so.
Could I suggest a certain structure to our conversation so we don't go on for 90 minutes? Let's just do a little bit about the brand new Gold Derby Spitballs for Best Picture, which, you know, for lack of any references, nobody's seen these films, but we can at least talk about what smells good to us, and I can go over, you know, the top 10. Did you look at those yesterday? I mean, some people came out with their own picks,
You posted it, right?
Yeah.
That was not your personal top 10.
Personal top 10. Yeah, I mean,
yeah. I go. That's what I thought. Okay.
The Gold Derby software gives you a choice of many, many maybes, and I just had a thought. Before we jump into this, you mentioned to me yesterday by email. What happened to Les Miserables, which we both loved in Cannes? That was a great neighborhood gang movie with the gangs versus the cops, and I thought I just loved that film. It was one of the high points. And it's funny, but you'd think it would get some replay in you know, if not Venice, then maybe Toronto anyway, and maybe New York. And I've not heard of. Any bookings, have you, or do you know what's going on with that?
No, I haven't heard anything about it. Right now, its best shot is Telluride, because we don't really know what to expect with half the lineup that Telluride's about to give us.
Yeah.
That's basically the best shot, or maybe it's a late addition to the Toronto Film Festival, but I doubt it. I find they would have probably announced it with the first wave titles.
Yeah.
So, I really liked it, especially the action. I thought it was the best Antoine Fuqua movie that Antoine Fuqua never really made.
Yeah,
but it was very good. And it's a black French filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
I think his name is Ladj Ly.
That's right.
If I remember.
Yeah, it's hard to hard to pronounce, but yeah.
Yeah, but I never expected the New York Film Festival to warm up to this movie because it is you know an action movie. It's Kukua-esque. So yeah. I mean, the highbrows in New York would have never.
You know, the highbrows would do themselves a favor and program a film like this every now and then for the New York Film Festival or for Toronto or for whatever, because there's certainly nothing derelict about it in terms of its filmmaking chops. And, you know, it's very taut and tight and it moves right along and it feels genuine to me. And the interesting thing, which I found out after I saw it, is that it takes place in the neighborhood where the actual, more or less, most of the actual Victor Hugo novel happened back in the mid-1800s.
Oh. Yeah, I read that too, and I didn't really know that until after the movie. But a lot of the French press there were very much aware.
Yeah.
That's even before the movie screened, that was part of the lure of the movie, in that it is, basically, it tackles the same themes as Les Misérables, except it's very urban and 21st century.
Yeah. So let's go over the top 10 of the Gold Derby. Yeah. Let's start with what I believe is the front runner, The Irishman, which I've heard, by the way, you're not wrong when you heard 200 minutes. I heard it's definitely three.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So you've got your epic length right there, and it's... I've read 80% of it. I admit that I skimmed through portions because I was hurried last night and I never, but I basically, you know, I know how it ends, I know what the tone of it is, and there is this kind of, it's, you know, it's the culture of mobs, the mob culture thing that Scorsese has been mining over and over in four previous films. This will be his fifth mob film since Mean Streets. And it's basically an elegy. It's a looking back, kind of a sad older man's film about who am I, what has my life amounted to, who am I, and have I let work and my calling in my tribe, in my crime gang, whatever you want to call it, have I let that overwhelm me as a person? And have I, you know, there's a tragic element to it.
It's basically... well, obviously we haven't seen the movie, but we've read the script.
Yeah.
I've read the book even, and when I was reading the book, I was like, yeah, this is more probably more silent than Goodfellas in terms of it's an elegy, and it's also a summation of every theme that Scorsese has been really working on for 4 or 5 decades now.
Yeah, right.
I would presume and I would expect for the movie to feel like it was made more by the guy who made Silence than the guy who made Goodfellas, and that's great. I'm really happy about that.
Yeah, I totally respect it. Yeah, and I love that he's. Tell me, you read the script as I did. I didn't get the feeling when I was reading it. I mean, I forget how many pages it is. It's something like 130, 140 pages, something like that. But I didn't get the feeling that this is a three-hour movie. It felt like a two-hour or two-and-a-half. So there's a lot of, I don't know what was added. You know, obviously the draft that you and I read was quite a few years old, so they added material, obviously. But
I remember you going to the Mean Street anniversary screening at Cannes.
Yeah.
If I remember correctly. And you had mentioned that Scorsese... had said that there were, what, 300 scenes?
That's what he said. And it was repeated, the same quote was repeated in the New York Times and somebody else. So I didn't hear it wrong. He did say that, so.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is also, at 200 minutes, that 300 scenes comment makes more sense.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, only two big studio movies have crossed the three-hour mark this decade.
Really?
Only two of them, and that is Avengers: Endgame and The Wolf of Wall Street.
Huh.
That's it.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah, whereas, I had written about this, whereas in the 90s there were 16 movies that crossed the 3-hour mark.
Mm-hmm. I think that the industry is going to say, however roused or excited or however the Irishman makes them feel emotionally, and there is this melancholy element, it's going to be regarded as a absolute landmark in terms of the de-aging aspect. And from what everybody has said, it's really quite brilliant in that respect. And so to take an actor in his, late 70s, De Niro, and make him look 30 years old, 35, whatever it is, it's going to be pretty amazing. And I think that for that alone, it's kind of a historical landmark. As much of a CG or special effects triumph as, say, the Parting of the Red Sea by Cecil B. DeMille in 1956. You know, one of those. It's one of those. People are going to definitely remember that as being a highlight. So that's the best picture thing right there, I think. So
that's part of the fascination that I have about The Irishman. Just without the de-aging, you have the potential. Forget about the de-aging for a sec. Mm-hmm. Without it, you just have the potential of an indisputably great movie being made here, with all these actors reuniting with Scorsese, and also you add in Pacino, who's never worked with Scorsese.
Yeah,
that's another major thing going on with this movie. But so you already have such a great story for Scorsese to tackle in the twilight of his years as a director.
Yeah.
And then you add this aging, which could add a groundbreaking aspect to the film, and you have something that could be very special here. But the only aging that we've seen so far, the only footage we've seen is that last shot in the trailer.
Yeah.
Correct. Okay.
Yeah.
What do you think of that last shot?
I was hugely impressed by it. It looked a little bit painted, but I don't expect absolute realism. I just want something that's not going to throw me off and make me feel that I can't believe it. I believed it totally. I was really impressed. What about you?
Right. It looks like De Niro from the 90s. So it looks like, he's in his 50s, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know. How old is he supposed to look in that scene? That's the question.
I think he's at least going to go back to the 1970s, I believe. So this is
right.
It's like 30 years, or who knows,
Okay. So I mean, in that scene alone, he looks like he's probably late 40s, early 50s.
Yeah.
So, but I think that's what they were going for. And Pesci too. I find they did a better job on De Niro than Pesci in that scene.
Yeah.
But I don't know. It's just very exciting to see Joe Pesci back too. And you know, you could just tell by the small amount of footage that we've seen that, you know, the guy is a great actor. He's a great dramatic actor.
Yeah.
He doesn't seem to have lost much of his talents for just...
Now, speaking of reading scripts, I really wish that someone had passed along to me, and I haven't been successful in this effort, but it was someone who passed me the... Marriage Story script, because the Noah Baumbach Marriage Story, which incidentally is also a Netflix thing on top of The Irishman. It's interesting that Netflix has the two hottest films of the Best Picture contending arena, if you will. And I everybody keeps saying that they might even be hotter on Marriage Story than they are in The Irishman. I'll reserve judgment on that. But I just, from a movie that's basically about the disintegration of a marriage and about the divorce and about the back and forth, it sounds great, sounds good, sounds like something I'm very, very much looking forward to that in Telluride, and so...
Just announced that the running time of Marriage Story is 2 hours and 16 minutes.
Okay.
So that's a meaty running time. It probably means, he's really going to go deep here. Baumbach doesn't always go deep with drama. There's always an air of
right.
of amusement and neuroticism to his films. But this seems like the real deal. It seems like it's pretty serious. I mean, I've heard comparisons to Kramer versus Kramer.
Yeah, who knows? Who knows? No, I threw, for my own list, by the way, I threw in Queen and Slim, which is basically a black Thelma and Louise, except it's a couple, kind of a Bonnie and Clyde thing, after the guy kills a cop who had drawn a gun on him, and they're on the run. And the reason I put it in there is because of a colleague, Jeff Snyder, having said he thinks that this is going to be the thing, because it's going to be a corrective on the part of the people of color in the Academy who hated that Green Book won, and this is the real black experience movie, and you know we're going to make a big thing about this because Green Book was not our film; it was the older white guy's movie, et cetera, et cetera. What do you think about all that?
Have you heard anything else about Queen of Slim except for that?
Nothing. Have you?
Just Snyder ever elaborate on that tweet, or it's just that tweet alone, basically?
Just that one. But he based it upon not an instinct. Apparently, he's Jeff, who has pretty good contacts. You know, he was persuaded by others that it's a that he thinks it's going to be a significant film. So who knows?
Yeah, I mean. Black-led movies this fall festival season, and
yeah.
I mean even Queen and Slim is skipping most of it, but I presume it's going to be at AFI maybe.
Yeah.
But and also in that tweet he had mentioned Just Mercy, which is premiering at TIFF, but it does seem like a conventional courtroom drama.
Right.
Inefficiencies of the justice system, but
so it's basically Cole Northside's. Just to be clear, the title of it is. Now I've forgotten the title. Help me out.
Just Mercy.
Oh, Just Mercy, right? Which is basically, if you're a film scholar and you know your old Jimmy Stewart movies, it's basically Cole Northside 777. Did you ever see that, by the way?
Yeah. But there's no footage that's been shown of Just Mercy.
Nothing.
Just
yeah.
And the
film 1917 is also. Hey, wait a minute. Let's stop. I can cut this out. But there's an echo thing going on here. What's happening? It's echoing way too much. I mean, there's some kind of reverb echo thing.
You still hear the echo?
No, it's gone. But it was happening for a second. It was like.
Yeah, it was. You were being cut off there.
Okay.
But now you're back.
Okay.
That's fine.
All right. So 1917 got thrown in because they put out a trailer just to remind everybody that they're coming at the end of the year, and I guess that means they'll start to show it in November or whatever. But it seems like you know, Sam Mendes with a audacious. But I don't know about the Birdman thing. It looks like the trailer didn't indicate a solid, you know, uncut experience. I saw a lot of cutting in the trailer itself, and I don't know how long. I mean, to have a film that's more or less an uncut thing, it means it's a fairly short time span. And the other thing was, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I don't even think it's a rumor that they're doing the Birdman thing with 1917. It's pretty much happening. And if anything, you know, the articles mentioning it would have been corrected by the studio. But it does look like it's one long take or artificial long take.
Oh, that's cool. That's okay, so they just avoided selling that aspect in the trailer, and it's. Okay, that's cool.
Yeah.
That's great. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I you know, you have a pretty underrated director there. Sam Mendes doesn't really hardly get mentioned that often.
Well, because he took himself out how many years ago? He said, I'm going to stop being a prestige-level director. I'm going to start doing James Bond films, and I'm going to get my artistic thrills through theater, which is fine. There's nothing just, you know, not uncool about that. It's just that's what he did. Mm-hmm. And he decided to stop being Sam Mendes of you know, the Tom Hanks gangster movie that he did.
Road to Perdition.
Yeah, Road to Perdition and American Beauty and Revolutionary Road. You know, he had a certain identity or handle, if you will, and he basically dropped that.
But he seems to have made one of the better Bond movies with Skyfall, so we'll give him credit for that.
Oh, no, not dismissing the Bond films that he made, but it's a kind of filmmaking that obviously doesn't aspire to high critical hosannas. It's just, you know, it's a type of satisfying filmmaking if it's done well. That's totally fine with me. I mean,
one of the Bond movies that he made was pretty bad, though. Quantum of
Solace.
No, it was called Spectre. That's right. I think it's Spectre that he directed.
Spectre? Okay.
Yeah, that wasn't good.
All right.
Also, he made that weird indie, Away We Go, which wasn't very good. I'm just on his page here. But yeah, I mean, the guy who made American Beauty, Road to Perdition, Jarheads, Revolutionary Road, it's good. But I understand why you would go to theater, which, you know, they're not, Hollywood's kind of being allergic to making anything original these days. But hey, good for him that he found 1917. It does look like a very good adult drama.
The audience has kind of been primed by the Peter Jackson documentary. You know, it kind of opened people's eyes up to that, to reality of that horrible encounter, that horrible war that was so gruesome for so many people.
Yeah, that was a real groundbreaking documentary.
I gotta say, the one thing that bothers me about 1917 is the basic plot, which is a guy whose brother is in another battalion. This guy has to somehow deliver a message to the commander of this other battalion to not go forward with an attack in a few hours, because if you do, unbeknownst to you, the odds are against you and all your men will be killed. So if you were trying to prevent something like that, that's a pretty terrible thing to, you know, contemplate. Would you just send one person to tell I would send like three messengers. I would send five of them. That means maybe one of them will get through. You know, I wouldn't just say, here, you do it. One guy, because your brother is in that battalion. And if you don't succeed, 1,600 men will die. That sounds like a forced kind of a Hollywood plot to me.
Yeah. But is it based on a true story? I actually didn't check. But I doubt it's based on a true story. There would have been probably more than one soldier sent there. Let's see. I mean, it may even skip AFI and it may just get a December release. But this building on this movie. So and that trailer really was met with mostly unanimously positive.
Sure.
Reaction. So yeah, no, it looks good. Let's go to number five.
I have Judy, just because I figured I should throw it in somewhere. I think that's going to be more of a performance thing for Renee Zellweger than anything else, probably. But it's about the last days of poor Judy Garland, who's having such a tough time with all the impurities in her system and alcohol and financial problems and all the rest of it. But it sounds... It looks, there is a short trailer that's been put out, like a pretty interesting, ambitious thing for Zellweger. And even though I myself, having anticipated for many years that Anne Hathaway would wind up playing Garland, because she looks like her and she sings and everything. But, you know, let's give it a shot. Let's be open to it. I think it'll be one of those things that's more, we kind of know what these biopics are going to be like. But, you know, I'll try and keep an open mind.
Point where Renee Zellweger had taken a major break after her Cold Mountain win from acting.
Yeah.
And then she came back and she didn't look at all like Renee Zellweger.
And the person who to blame for that was Owen Gleiberman. They tried to actually cancel Owen Gleiberman in the cancel culture, the PC cancel culture, went after him big time because it's bad form. Don't you dare suggest that anybody of the female persuasion had any work. Listen, a lot of people have work. It's normal in the acting community. It's not a big deal, but they got very upset about it. And, of course, they eventually tried to stop killing him. But they really were on him. They were, like, saying, this guy is bad news. He doesn't understand women. He's terrible. It was really a cruel episode, but they got through it.
But he was right.
Yeah, he was right. Of course he was right. But he it wasn't that he was right. It's that he said it. He said that there was a, you know. And the whole internet was saying, who is that? She didn't even look like, what happened to the girl in Jerry Maguire? She's gone, so.
That's right.
Yeah,
I mean, something happened. But one thing I noticed from this trailer is that she does look a little more like Renee Zellweger.
Yeah.
She did when she came out with that new face a few years ago.
Right.
But Judy's going to be big, I think.
Yeah.
And also, Judy Garland's story does resonate even more today. She was used and abused in Hollywood, and her life was cut short because, you know, she was surrounded by very toxic men, and she had really bad experiences with men.
Yeah.
And I think hopefully this movie does tackle that.
But the poor woman is such a sad thing to see what too many pills and too much booze. I mean, she looked like she was in her mid-60s at least, if not older. And she was only, 47 when she died? It was really, really tragic. Really sad.
Yeah, all those drugs and probably lack of sleep. She just aged terribly overnight.
Yeah. So what do you think of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood's chances to be a Best Picture contender? It's obviously well-liked. I think it gets in just because people like it. What do you think?
It gets in because, first of all, I thought it was very good, but it gets in because it's one of the few movie events that we've had this year. There haven't been many. The Irishman is going to be another one. Those Hollywood auteurs that, every time they release a movie, it is an event. There aren't many left. There's Scorsese, there's Tarantino.
Yeah.
So just by that notion, it would probably get into Best Picture. I think it's a shoo-in at this point.
Yeah, me too. People are so grateful that it aspired to be a real movie in the kind of the 70s or 80s sense. I mean, people were so grateful not to have to deal with another Avengers or, you know, whatever. It just made everybody feel great about being movie lovers. And so there's such an outpouring of grateful emotion, not to mention the very gentle and the very kind ending that everybody loves. And so it's a nice...
I do wonder what he will be tackling next. I mean, he keeps giving us hints here and there. Today he said that he wouldn't mind having his 10th and final film to be a horror movie.
Oh my gosh, did he say that?
He's just all over the place. And a few weeks ago he mentioned how he wouldn't mind that 10th and final film to be the R-rated Star Trek movie he's been working on for a year or two.
Mm-hmm.
But it says a lot about the current state of mainstream Hollywood movies that we are just so excited for a new movie by Quentin Tarantino to be in theaters. It's especially this summer where there hasn't really been a lot of big studio achievements.
Sure.
Speaking. There's been the Tarantino, and I didn't really think Toy Story 4 was that good. There hasn't been much, really.
Another film that's been thrown into the Best Picture maybe list is, of course, Greta Gerwig's Little Women, because of, you know, it's a classic story. It's been made three times before. This will be the fourth version. It's got some really good performances. Everybody's been hearing that Frances Pugh is... got to stand out, and that Saoirse Ronan is going to be very good, and I believe that Meryl Streep is in it. Is that true? I can't remember.
Oh, she's in it.
Yeah. And she's also in the and she's in the Soderbergh also, the Laundromat.
Right, which is not in your top 10.
Well, only because I was frankly hearing from you and some others that it's more of a kind of a dry comedy, and it's only because this is not my personal preferences of what I would expect to like. It's about what I think is probably going to punch through as popular enough to be Best Picture nominated, and people generally are find Soderbergh stuff to be a little oblique, a little dry, a little, you know, not quite on the nose enough for them. I love Soderbergh's stuff, and I loved his basketball movie recently. I mean, it's very rare when I'm not happy about a Steven Soderbergh film, but I just didn't think it. When I heard it was dry and kind of satiric and maybe a little comedic, I've just said people are gonna put it in a box and not regard it as Best Picture material.
I immediately thought of The Informant when I heard a few people describe The Laundromat to
me.
And I don't mind that at all. I love The Informant.
Me too.
It's such a hoot, and it features maybe Matt Damon's best performance.
Yeah.
But something happened with Soderbergh after...
After Che, right?
Yeah, no, I would go even before that. After he was crowned as, you know, Hollywood royalty with Aaron Brockovich and Traffic, he kind of tried to deviate away from the Oscar base, and I don't mind that at all.
Yeah.
Because it ended up giving us some really original, unique movies. But when The Laundromat was announced, I really thought he may be going back to Oscar bait, but it doesn't seem so now, because after all the accounts I've heard, and this does seem to very much fit with latter day Soderbergh. And it's not going to Telluride. I really wonder. I really wonder why.
Yeah, I was really disappointed. I mean, if the Telluride slate says one thing, it said we're not terribly interested, except for, maybe Marriage Story. But we're not really interested in movies that are going to sell popcorn this fall. We're interested in movies that we like, that meet the Telluride standards, the cultivated cineast standards that we believe in. And it's, you know, there's what's popcorn in Telluride? Nothing, really, except for possibly the Baumbach. They're not going to show 1917. They're not going to. Oh wait, Judy. That's. I guess that's a popcorn movie. Okay.
Yeah, I guess so. But I wouldn't even categorize Marriage Story as popcorn. Just from the looks of it, it's a.
Well, I mean, when I say popcorn, I mean, you know, an emotional current that an average person is going to understand and relate to.
Right. Yeah. Mainstream fare.
Yeah.
I mean, but at the same. Yeah. I don't want to really categorize the Baumbach as anything, because, I mean, he never really directed a commercial movie. I can't really think of a movie he directed that would please the mainstream.
Yeah, exactly.
We've spoken about Marriage Story as one of your picks.
About what story? Back, what?
Marriage Story.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Going back to the Soderbergh, I think once it's screened, once it's seen, we're probably going to understand why it didn't go to Telluride.
Okay.
It happens every year. We wonder, why didn't this movie go to Telluride? And then when that movie is finally seen, we're like, okay, I get it. I understand.
Yeah.
But a bewildering omission from Telluride this year, even more bewildering than The Laundromat, would be A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood.
Yeah, they bypassed that.
That's a female director.
Yeah. It's funny. I don't know. I
So.
don't understand that. The only thing that I can figure is that there's, I guess, some surprise or consternation about it's not really a Tom Hanks showcase movie. He's almost, I'm not sure. Obviously, I haven't seen it. And I haven't really read, but he's more of a support. Mr. Rogers, Fred Rogers, more of a supporting character, and that the real lead is played by what's his name, the reporter. The Tom Juno, based upon Tom Juno of Esquire, and can you think of his name, the actor? So we're both
Oh my
drawing
gosh.
blanks.
Yeah, we're
Anyway,
drawing blanks, but he's a known actor.
yeah, I
Yeah.
understand it's more his story than it is. It's more of his arc anyway. I mean, I'm. What I understand is that Tom Hanks and Fred Rogers are, front, right in the main spotlight of the story. But I understand it's more about this reporter's emotional journey with his father, and who's apparently ill, and that sort of thing. So who knows? But that's what I understand.
Judging by the way Telluride has been operating these last few years,
Yeah.
I would have expected Marielle Heller to have the movie
Me too.
at Telluride.
Yeah.
But from what I've been hearing, Toronto has been very strict this year. They're really going just balls out in trying to secure as many world premieres as possible, and they put down restrict. More restrictive rules this year to really nab these movies. For example, The Lighthouse, they basically put a hold on it ever since it premiered at Cannes, so
Yeah.
that it can't really premiere anywhere else except at Toronto. And that's going to be huge screening in Toronto. Supposedly, it's bound to sell out in a few minutes once tickets go on sale. The Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, the trailer went viral, and the trailer's become a sensation.
Sure.
I have a feeling this movie's going to make a lot of money.
Yep, I agree.
And the fact that it's premiering in Toronto tells me that, yes, Toronto is starting to really, really get into the fight of really getting those world premieres, because last year they world premiered the Best Picture winner,
Yeah. Yeah,
and
that was
now
the
we're starting.
surprise. Remember that Green Book, of course, at Toronto, but remember when Universal and Toronto decided to screen it, which was after the crowd leaves. The crowd is at Toronto for the first 5 days, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, and then they start to leave on Tuesday. That's the night when Green Book premiered, on a Tuesday night, and it was, of course, we all know what happened, but it was, it indicated that somebody in Universal, they weren't so sure they had a really big thing. They on some level they were ambiguous. Who knows? But they wouldn't
Yeah.
have, if they really believed it was rocket fuel, they would have had it in the first 5 days. I know that.
I would see that Tuesday night at Toronto as the last big night. So I mean, they on a technicality level, they did premiere it in a spot that was, that was still very friendly to
Oh,
audiences.
I appreciate. Yes, Tuesday is certainly a hotter, more intense night than, say, the second week, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. That's really when people are gone. But
Yeah, that's
a
when
lot of people
we're
do
gone.
leave on Monday, though. I know that. It's not.
Oh,
It's.
I know. I mean, at Cannes, we even met people that were leaving before the Tarantino was showing, which was mind-boggling.
Strange.
People tend to just show up for the first few days of a film festival, or the major film festival, and then they just go, which is preposterous in my books,
What
but.
do you think, by the way? I mean, the more I think back upon The Lighthouse, the more, thoroughly steeped it is in the late 1800s, and that Melville-like dialogue, And yeah. I just, it's such a complete immersion in this separate world, and so fully and intensely realized with the dreams and the shots of King Triton and the mermaids, and it's really something. And do you think it has a shot at a Best Picture thing, or are people going to say, nah, you know, Spirit Awards, we're not going to consider it, not our type of film? What do you think?
Well, before I answer that, I do have to say The Lighthouse is the one movie from Cannes that I really cannot wait to see again.
Yeah, me too.
And mostly because we went to an 8 a.m. screening. I remember we woke up at 6 a.m., I remember, and we went to the 8 a.m. screening. But this is the kind of movie that must play incredibly well as a midnight screening.
Yeah.
So, or seeing it at 9, 10 p.m. instead of 8 a.m. because the atmosphere is very much after hours, and it's just soaked in this beautiful, misery-filled black and white. And does it stand a chance at getting an Oscar nomination for Best Picture? Of course. But will it eventually get that Best Picture nomination? I'm skeptical, because it's genre fair, and we've seen it with The Hereditary not getting in and The Witch not getting in.
But it's a little better than Hereditary in that respect. It's so it's not really blatantly horrific. It's spooky, but it's not really horror, I don't think. It's more of a psychological film than a horror film.
Plus, it has Robert Pattinson, and that'll probably give it some extra popularity.
Yeah.
And make it and mainstream it a little more. I don't know. To tell you the truth, I haven't even thought of The Lighthouse being a Best Picture nominee. But yeah, it's possible.
Yeah. What do you think of Jojo Rabbit? I mean, I have a very high skeptical attitude about Jojo Rabbit, because I think that the obviously broad satiric tone of completely having no interest in trying to deliver atmosphere and culture and just the historical flavor of early 1940s Vienna, there's obviously no interest in doing that. It's very, you know, everybody's japing, everybody's having fun. Overacting, it's the director himself playing a kind of a phantom ghost-like Adolf Hitler character with a New Zealand Maori accent. It just seems kind of silly, but I shouldn't take that attitude, because I don't know how the whole piece feels. But I've been told that, oh no, it's really good. I've seen it twice, and you know, you really don't be negative. You know, I'm not being negative. I'm just skeptical. That's all.
I just realized that you didn't put Jojo Rabbit in your top 10.
Oh, no, I didn't. You're implying that I should have, and I erred by not doing so, right?
It's by far, judging from the people I've spoken to, it's by far the hottest ticket at CIS. There is no hotter ticket, and then they announced yesterday that they're giving Taika Waititi a special tip prize. The boot this year, a prize that I believe Martin Scorsese and many illustrious directors have won in the past. I'm skeptical right now about Jojo Rabbit, given the fact that I would think there might be a backlash to the way it depicts 1940s Vienna, and really how it puts a friendly face on fascism. That to me is going to be its biggest problem. I have no problem with it doing that. I'm completely open-minded, and I'm ready to embrace this movie. I think the idea has potential, but why is it not at Telluride, and why is it not at Venice? And why is it not in New York? It's just at Toronto.
I would ask there's a lot of ways you can do a story about a young kid who's been enlisted in a kind of a hate group, which obviously Nazism was as far as the Jewish population was concerned. And then he is turned and is, he changes his mind about who he is and what he believes over the course of the film. And because there's a young girl, I believe, that's being hidden in his home that he didn't know about, something like that. And you can do that all sorts of different ways. There's a lot of hate groups and a lot of ways you could. So why, if you have no interest in trying to recreate or, you know, bring people into the time period of Austria in 1940 or 41, what's the point? Why not just do it some kind of modern variation that'll feel more real? So, you know, why go so broadly satiric and with absolutely indifferent to realism? I just, that's the only part that bothers me.
Yeah, the trailer doesn't hint at any kind of realism. It all seems like fantasy,
yeah.
Fantasy world, right. Where mm-hmm. fascism is, again, I hate to use this word, it's friendly, and it's a very strange way of going about things, especially in 2019, where the words fascism and Nazi are being used left and right.
Mm.
That its meaning almost becomes empty. And this film is doing that term a disservice, I find. But at the same time, again, I am looking forward to seeing what Taika Waititi is doing with Jojo Rabbit. He is a very talented visualist.
Yeah.
And but what do you think of its marketing campaign? Its marketing campaign is quite unique. There was the Hitler meme, which I think you wrote about. I'm not sure. It's as if they're not really they're trying to imply, do not take us so seriously. I'm perplexed. I know the marketing for Jojo Rabbit has a lot of fans, but I'm kind of perplexed by it. I'm not sure what to really make of it.
Mm. What do you think about The Farewell hanging in here and becoming a Best Picture thing? It really touched a chord, and I think obviously it. An all-Asian, pretty much all-Asian cast, and a very emotionally touching film about the generations and about, you know, facing death and the whole thing. Pretty moving film. I mean, really, like, I didn't tear up, but it was very moving. It really was. I mean, it's no question.
Yeah.
It really hits the spot for me. So
That's one of your top 10 picks.
Yeah.
For Best Picture,
yeah.
And I agree. But I've been predicting Best Picture for this movie since I saw it at Sundance. I was looking at all the titles that played at Sundance when the festival ended, and I was like, wow, there's really only A Farewell that stands out. And usually Sundance has at least one movie that becomes a Best Picture nominee, and I was like, well, if there's one movie this year that could do it, it's probably The Farewell.
Yeah.
And it seems to have gained momentum ever since Sundance. Now it's a box office art house hit. Everyone I've spoken to is like the movie. I have not really met anyone that said, "Oh, The Farewell, that's a bad movie," or I was disappointed by The Farewell. It seems to be garnering universal praise, and it's Rotten Tomatoes is at 99% out of 200, 300 reviews. I just can't see this movie failing in its quest for a Best Picture nomination.
Interesting, by the way, one thing I have not paid any attention to, but is going to TIFF, but not to Telluride, as far as I know, not Venice, is Dolomite Is My Name, the Eddie Murphy thing, directed by Craig Brewer, and Scott and Larry, Scott Alexander and Larry Karczewski are the screenwriters, and it's Eddie Murphy is the star, and it's based upon a real guy, a guy who's a comedian and blaxploitation films. And yeah, you hear anything at all about this? I don't hear a word.
I'm just speculating here, but it's from the looks of it. Eddie Murphy is really trying to get back that street cred that he lost with all these miserable movies that he's made. These just, you know, these very unintelligent mainstream marketed comedies of the last 20 years, right. really. I mean, he has Dolomite coming out. I do notice that it's not in your top 10 picks anymore. You took it off.
I took it off because I didn't realize in my haste before I went to see The Kitchen last night that I had forgotten to put in the Tarantino, and I realized that was a big mistake. So as soon as I got back, I put in the Tarantino and I took out Dolomite.
Yeah, I don't know much about Dolomite. I know it's a Netflix movie, so maybe they'll be campaigning for Eddie Murphy as best actor. Who knows? But Eddie Murphy also just signed a $70 million contract with Netflix to produce a few stand-up comedy specials. So now he's really going back to his glory days serious acting in Dolomite and stand-up. And he also has the Coming to America sequel coming out, which a lot of people are anticipating. A lot of nostalgia-induced people are anticipating that sequel. I think we're going to see a little comeback from Eddie Murphy in the next few years. So, Dolomite is not, it should not be ignored. It could very well, and plus Craig Brewer, he did Hustle and Flow, which is fantastic.
That was a wonderful film. That's one of my favorite films of this century. I've watched that film about 6 or 7 times, so.
Yeah, and it's not the kind of movie that you're like, oh yeah, I mean, it's just driven by the acting and the story. I mean, the direction in that movie is very good.
Yeah.
So it turned me into a Craig Brewer fan, even though he hasn't really done much since.
Let's briefly, already at the limit here time-wise, but let's briefly review some Tellurites that are not part of what you would call the Best Picture conversation, the speculative Best Picture conversation. What I had heard about Ford versus Ferrari from somebody who passed along a couple of research screening remarks was that it's a good film that will be more of a Golden Glober than an Oscar thing, whatever that means.
Yeah. There's shades of Rush, Ron Howard movie that I'm feeling with the trailer and with the story.
Yeah.
Again, it's about two very competitive racing men.
Yeah.
And just they're back and forth. Mm-hmm. And it's 2 hours and 10 minutes from what I've been told.
Uh-huh.
So that's that length kind of tells you that they're probably going for a home run here.
Yeah.
But I don't know. We'll see, but Telluride will also have Uncut Gems, which I know you were going to get to next.
You know what? What'd you say?
Uncut Gems?
Yeah.
From the States.
The Softies,
The Softies. Which is, you know, again, Adam Sandler trying to do drama. What do you think of that movie's potential?
I think that Sandler was really, really good, and I admired everything he was trying to do in the Meyerowitz stories.
Yeah.
And I totally loved his acting as a guy dealing with the death of his family from the 9/11 disaster Lean on Me, was it called? The Mike Binder film. Rain Over Me, I think it was called.
Rain Over Me. Yeah.
So I'm very much looking forward to it. I think it's going to be exciting. That's one of my top excitement films at Telluride, after Marriage Story and Judy and Motherless Brooklyn. I'm very hot on, which I don't know very much about, but it's, Ed Norton's a sharp dude, so I'm looking forward to that. I wonder why do you think that the Corrida film, The Truth, which is, everybody respects Corrida's resume and all that, why do you think that wouldn't make it to New York Film Festival? It's funny, because he's... Weird.
I don't know. I hear it's very minor. It's a very minor movie. Anytime a very, very well-respected foreign filmmaker
yeah.
tries to make an English language movie, a lot of times it fails. I mean, we saw it, Wong Kar Wai tried it.
Okay.
I can understand why this Koreeda might be a disappointment.
Okay.
But it was chosen at Venice, and it was chosen at for Telluride.
Yeah.
So I do wonder, maybe it's good, I don't know, but it's definitely not going to be a masterpiece I didn't think Shoplifters was a masterpiece, but a lot of people thought
yeah.
it was. But I don't think it'll be perceived as a masterpiece.
Okay.
Shoplifters.
And the biggest head-scratcher for me is all the enthusiasm for the Aeronauts, which just sounds like a kind of a family Disney movie on some level. I know that's not at all fair of me to say, but that's been my impression because of... So I'm completely open and interested to see something else happen, but it just sounds escapist, you know, in a kind of a fun way,
yeah.
kind of a family way, you know? I don't know.
Have you seen Tom Harper's Wild Rose?
No, I haven't. I should have seen that. I know that I should have. It's derelict of me to have missed it, but no, I didn't.
Yeah, for a rags to riches story, it's pretty well made, and the central performance is very good.
Okay.
But the Aeronauts buzz started. I forgot how it started. I think I. You know what? Yeah, I was told about test screenings that were happening for the Aeronauts and
mm-hmm.
how they were just very successful test screenings.
Right.
And that they were ready to position the film as a contender at film festivals.
Mm-hmm.
You know what? It was supposed to be at Venice, but then last minute they ended up pulling it from Venice. I don't know what happened there. So now they seem to be very keen on it going to Toronto and Telluride.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't know much more about it, but,
right.
But it's supposed to be taking place. I think 70-80% of the movie is in that air balloon.
Yeah. That seems, I can't believe that that's the case. I mean, I know you've said that, and I'm not disputing
yeah.
It came from.
Yeah.
But think of that, a 70% of a film taking place in an air balloon? That's like Alfred Hitchcock's Lifeboat taking place entirely in a lifeboat. I mean, that's a real stunt of, I mean, what can happen in an air balloon that can generate enough drama, you know? It just seems really...
I know, but it strikes me as more interesting movie if, in fact, 70% of it is in that balloon.
Okay.
Compared to possibly just a conventional narrative of, flashback, flash forward.
Yeah.
That's my hope for the Aeronauts. I actually really do hope that it's what they call a bottle movie in which it takes place in, the majority of it takes place in one setting. That would be the best case scenario for
mm-hmm.
the Aeronauts, but we'll see.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, looking at the rest of the Telluride list, I mean, there's Wasp Network by Asayas, which was not chosen for the New York Film Festival, which is mind-boggling, considering she's basically the New York absolutely cooking guy. I haven't heard much about it. I know it is supposed to be based on a true story.
Uh-huh.
Taking place in Latin America.
Okay.
It's a globetrotting kind of film about five Cuban political prisoners.
Okay.
And how they were imprisoned by the U.S. in the late 90s on charges of espionage and murder. That's about all I know. And I know Penelope Cruz plays the wife of one of the prisoners.
Okay.
But other than that, I don't know much. And then there's the two popes, which, again, we'll play Telluride. I don't know much about that movie either. But
I think we should let it go with this, and then we can get into the festivals if you want to do something next week. You know, because there's obviously plenty to talk about. We're just having, you know, we. I think it's better to keep it to 45 or whatever, an hour.
I think if we start doing podcasts weekly, maybe 45 minutes. Max an hour in the because we can talk for 3 hours. But,
yeah, I was. It's funny. I've been my concerns this today are, besides doing the column, I was thinking, golly, I really, really hate the idea of having to pay for a rental car from Durango and then come back 4.5 days later and I have a $450 bill. I hate paying all that money just for a rental car. So I struck upon a possible solution. And the solution was this. I would forget the rental car and take an Uber from Durango Airport to Dolores, Colorado, which is about $70. And I would meet Sasha Stone and her caravan. She goes in her big SUV, and she has two guys to go with her, plus her two dogs. And I was saying, maybe they could give me a lift the last, you know, hour and a half, and I don't have to worry about a rental car. And then I can go back with her, and the same thing, you know, take a Uber from Dolores back to Durango, which would be perfect. Then she tells me, well, actually, I don't think that's going to work because there's a guy that I also picking up in Phoenix or somewhere near there, somewhere in Arizona, who's also going to come with us. So she has three guys with her, plus two dogs, plus all their bags, so there's no room.
She always goes with the same guy, I think, right?
There's a guy who takes care of her dogs. The dogs, I mean, somebody that brings her two dogs, and the dogs are a big part of her Telluride thing because of... you know, she wants somebody to kind of hang with them and feed them and take care of them while she's bobbing around screenings, so.
Yeah. And does the guy watch movies too, or not really?
Say again?
Does the guy that goes with her get into screenings, or he's really just...
He just hangs out at the condo and feeds the dogs and just, you know, chills.
Oh, wow.
So.
Oh, she has it figured out then.
Yeah.
Is her daughter going with her again this year?
She didn't say so.
Okay.
I think between those three guys, plus the two dogs, plus the bags, I'd probably no room for the daughter. You know, I love, speaking of Sasha's daughter, I love that anecdote she dropped on Twitter this morning, that her daughter's boyfriend, who's 20, said to the daughter, I guess in conversation with Sasha listening, who is Charles Manson? I was just thinking, you know, I mean, how many major, infamous, world-class, repellent villains of the 20th century. He's up there in the top three or four, right? I mean, Adolf Hitler, Charles Manson, Pol Pot, you know, extermination of so many hundreds of thousands of people during the 70s.
Yeah, but I'm sure you've read you've read about this too, but there seems to be plenty of millennials that don't know who the Beatles are, if you can believe it.
That can't be. You're telling me you know, you've heard personally some stories, some people, you know, who know somebody and they're... sure you're not talking Gen Z? You're not talking about people who are younger than millennials? Millennials don't know who the Beatles were?
Oh, yeah. Actually, I'm talking about this generation, so I guess they're not millennials anymore, right? They're
Gen Zers. Yeah.
Yeah, Gen Zers. I'll send you a few articles that I remember reading.
All right.
After this call is done, but
right.
You could. It's quite maddening to read about it, but and there's plenty of YouTube videos where they interview kids and they're like, you know, the Beatles, and they have no idea. It's very sad. So,
and especially with today's easy access. I mean, you can get up to snuff on basic Beatles stuff in a matter of 3 minutes if you want. All you have to do is just read the bios, read the Wikipedia page. You're there. You got it. You know, it's not like you have to know somebody who personally likes their music. You know, it just... look them up. Boom. You're done, you know. Listen to a couple of songs on the headphones, and you're done. You got it.
Yeah, they seem stuck in their I mean, you wrote about this, about how Kumail Nanjiani said that millennials and Gen Zers don't even go to the movies anymore. They just go on YouTube all day, every day. And they basically, it's like virtual reality for them. They're basically, they come home from school, they're on YouTube all day.
It's
quite interesting the way the new generation is shaping up. They're...
Mm-hmm.
But you would think that if you're on YouTube, there might be the potential to, you know, stumble upon the Beatles and be like, oh,
yeah,
that's interesting.
Yeah.
But no, not really. It's very strange generation.